Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is April 7th, 2026, and this is episode 595. I am the co-host, Mark Ames. I am in Western New York State on the Erie Canal. I should say it was the 200th anniversary of the Erie Canal last year. And we had a member of the Radio Warner Facebook community showing off a great ride on the far Ohio end of the, I guess it would have been the Miami link to the Erie Canal.
Yeah, there's a Miami in Ohio. I don't quite understand it, but somehow there is.
Right. Well, yeah, it's all these different canals, I guess, ultimately linking to various entryways into the Great Lakes, or yeah, is probably what it is. And their ride there includes very authentic mules.
I mean, you got to love the mules.
That is so cool. I know. I was really impressed because we have like, you know, kind of hokey, boats here, the Sam Patch boat here in our part of Rochester. But mules, you only get to see like, I don't know, illustrations of mules and descriptions of mules, but you know, and where the mules, you know, dragged the boats, like what part of the locks or wherever where they dragged boats, but you don't actually get to see it. It's pretty cool. Anyways, I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, AKA Gary Brecher in Southern Italy. How you doing, John?
Well, you know, like inside this apartment, we're fine. Outside, I don't know. It feels a lot like, and perhaps this is because I've read too much science fiction, it feels a lot like the scene where the deer leader or whoever finally reveals whatever it is that has been inhabiting his flesh, and it's not pretty. I mean, that the first phrase of Trump's tweet for tonight is, "A whole civilization will die tonight." That doesn't even sound like him.
No.
It sounds frighteningly unlike him. Like some other voice is now going to come out of of that thorax.
It's true. Like his head kind of peels open, then it's like, a whole civilization will die tonight. Yeah. Earthlings, never to be brought back again. it really is. It is so horrible because this guy actually has the power of life and death over the world and is exercising it unlike any president previously that I can imagine.
Although he was pushing it for a long time. To the point that, I mean, as someone who sort of slept or yawned through constitution classes, I've asked, like on Facebook many times, who said there was a constitution? Why isn't it like activated by now? And it really seems to me, and I know I'm ignorant about this, but seems to me that it's a kind of pacifist army of a constitution. Like it's throwing flower bombs at best at the people who want to destroy it.
By the way, real quickly, I just want to remind people you're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe. This could be the last day of all our lives. So anyway, subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. To your point, I mean, I would just channel like our originalist, friend of the show, historian William Hoagland, who, you know, well, I'd have to actually ask him, and I'm going to be putting words into his mouth maybe, so know that these aren't his words, but mine. But the presidency, at least how Hamilton definitely wanted, Hamilton wanted it to be a dictator or a king or an elected king. I mean, the Constitution is actually an incredibly archaic document, you know? We're seeing like this idea of just sticking to this very archaic document, which has been manipulated and fudged every which way. But like, if we let go of this document and try and come up with a new contract, it's as if everything goes to chaos. So we're going to stick to it. But it is not by, it, you know, I think basically we've been sold a lot of cant and fairy tales about the Constitution. It does actually allow not just the Constitution, but the way the whole state has developed, especially since America became an empire, and especially since the end of World War II. It concentrates enormous power totally outside of any democratic accountability and in the hands of whoever is president. And so we are at the whims of elected kings, you know, and the idea has always been that everybody is going to play along, sort of like in a civics class when you have rules in a game. And, you know, I don't know if you ever played like one of those, everybody's a country, every class is a country competing against each other. Yeah. But like, what if one class actually had all the weapons and could just, and like, I don't know, and just decided to break the rules? Had a gun and put it up to the teacher's head and said, the rules are different now, you know, like.
Yeah, and if the designated opposition for the most trivial reasons one could see in historical terms wanted to go silent suddenly, which they have. The Democratic Party, the official opposition, what have they said? What have they said about any of this? I'm sure they talk in their little echo chambers that are hardly even meant to trigger any reaction in the broader populace. I'm sure they talk about what a shame and a disgrace all this is.
Yes.
But it's not meant to go any further. I mean, If ever they needed a serious populist speaker, they didn't seem to want one. I mean, partly because the most bellicose moves were on behalf of the Israel's war, and they were quietly in favor of that. Mm-hmm. And then it grew like a cancer, and and they wouldn't stop it at any point.
Yeah, I think right now the kind of the most vocal opponent is Ro Khanna. He's actually a congressman from what sort of my area in the South Bay, you know, San Jose area. And he's, you know, he's good, but he's a lawyer. He's a lawyer. Yeah. He was a lawyer at the big Silicon Valley firm, Wilson Sonsini. Somehow he got elected around the time that Bernieism was rising, and he's tacked kind of populist-y since then. He's not a compelling speaker, but he's solid. Like, for example, he co-sponsored with Tom Massie, who's that Kentucky libertarian that Trump hates and is trying to get rid of. He co-sponsored a bill to, to get a War Powers Act voted on, whatever the hell that is. But that's like trying to be a way, you know, it does bother the White House if they actually do try to impose a War Powers Act and force Trump to ask them for money for his war. But of course that failed because the Democrats always have rotating villains. So they calculate how many people need to turn and side with the Republicans on a vote like that. So if we need five, we need three, we need two or whatever. It always appears. There's always the rotating villain, the Joe Manchin or the Kristen Sinema or whatever. So these things will never pass.
But if you look at the names of people who stick in the popular mind, if you can call it that, it's really striking. And it's time, I think we said, the legal opposition in the U.S. is pretty goddamn worthless.
Yeah.
And a little of the discipline and willingness to confront power, if you want to put it that way, on the right is just far beyond anything that you see on the legal squeamish left. Like Tucker Carlson calling on troops to disobey their orders. Mm-hmm. Marjorie Taylor Greene defecting from Trump in a way that is sort of like a religious dispute, and calling him out again and again and again, and resigning her position.
She just called for the 25th Amendment. I don't know if you saw that, which is to remove him from office.
Yeah.
Even Alex Jones is turning on Trump and called for 25th Amendment. I think Rod Dreher did. It's interesting. I mean, this is something I've been talking about since last year, that the split in MAGA. Now, I think the voting base is still most overwhelmingly with Trump and ready to go with him. But it matters that these very big names, Tucker Carlson, MTG, maybe Alex Jones, I don't know how big he still is. I mean, everybody knows his name. But definitely those two, and Candace Owens, who has a massive audience, and Nick Fuentes, who's got a massive audience. They're all very, very anti-Trump. And it matters because, you know, as somebody who's been watching the right for many years and who, you know, going back to the Reagan years, like the right has never really split like this, so especially so early in a term. And they really have, and they're... Unfortunately, at least in terms of that level of influence, they're just a lot more compelling and articulate. I mean, Tucker especially. And I don't like Tucker's politics, but I'm kind of getting sick of having to qualify anything. Like, the immediate fascist threat, the absolute 1 through 10 immediate fascist threat is Trump and his wars. Like, that's it. So if you're opposing that, Tucker Carlson says and stands for some shitty things I don't like, but like, he is leading people, and it matters more to Trump if you're leading a split on the right.
I want to say that I also am getting tired of this, because whatever force emerges in the anti-Trump ranks and defines itself as a progressive person or movement, there will be this crabs in a bucket feeling among the really dedicated people who are just advanced enough to shoot down any stirring in their own ranks, that we have to go over everything they've said for the last 20 years. And if there's anything questionable from any angle, they have to be erased. What has that gotten us? What good is that?
It's gotten the Democratic Party establishment to hold on to all of their sinecures and their power. And that's a lot of power and a lot of money. And that is the primary, I don't know, purpose of that party, is to hold on to their power and to really to fight any insurgencies on their left flank. And that's why in the middle of this incredibly dangerous war, with the most dangerous president, they have spent the last 2 weeks focused on one thing, and that is canceling Hassan Piker, who's really good. I've started listening to him. I have to admit, I've seen him around and stuff, and I've heard little clips. I didn't really listen to him properly until he went on our friends at American Prestige. And he's really good. He's very articulate, very good. And so naturally they're trying to cancel him for, you know, you can scour everything and take out of context and then slap the old anti-Semitic label on him, which is what they do. But the reason they're canceling him is not just because they don't like him, although they don't, but as a way to discipline any insurgent candidates in primaries. Any candidates that are aligning with him or appearing with him or going on his show. The hypocrisy is just like through the roof. None of them have a problem with the fact that Gavin Newsom went on Ben Shapiro's show or any of this stuff. And also underneath a lot of this is establishment, liberal, democratic, you know, Islamophobia and racism.
There's a lot of that.
Yeah. So that's what matters most, is holding on to it. And I think that also explains the just absolutely baffling, you know, non-opposition party response to all this. I mean, I just saw a mom when I was pumping gas, which has gone up massively here. You know, I was pumping gas at the station this morning after dropping the kids off at school. And I saw another mom that I know. And like one of the first things out of her mouth, she's a, you know, she's very cool. She's a microbiologist, a virologist. And she's like, she's very much a kind of down the line Democrat, as far as I know. And she's like, we have no, she was just complaining. We have no opposition party. We have no, where are the Democrats? Why aren't they saying anything? Their goal, I think their plan has been, you remember how their plan was to play possum, right? So their idea right. is we'll do nothing. Just hide, let Trump make all of his mistakes, however much he torches the world. Well, that's too bad, but that only helps us hold on to our power. Because if we get politically active, what we find is that the Democratic base is extremely angry, is suffering, and wants much more radical politics. And that threatens them. I mean, just again, look at what Graham Platner's doing. In this is the guy with the Nazi tattoo who was in Blackwater, but who says a lot of great things for a Democrat, you know, insurgent, his anti-war, anti-politics.
I just want to mention, I think I've mentioned this before. There's a movie called Mephisto that really seems important at this point. It's a theater group, and the central character is an insane egoist who ends up enmeshed in Nazi Party politics. But there's this side character who's not a very good actor or anything and almost immediately joins the Nazi Party. And then in a few scenes later, he is out of the Nazi Party and he's a street-fighting communist, and that's the way he dies. And that's I think... a kind of mistake that has a certain nobility and that you have to allow people to make. I mean, because at least it's a brave person's mistake.
Yeah.
And a little bravery from the left would be very welcome now.
Yeah, and that is why I think people are gravitating so much to this guy, Graham Platner. He's one of the few, one of the very few even sort of primary candidates who's running like that. I mean, Platner is running very hard against the Democratic Party establishment, very hard against the war, against supporting Israel, against Israel's genocide, against all the different ways that the oligarchy is ripping people off. And this is, you know, the donors to the Democratic Party hate this. And what the people who are in charge of the Democratic Party want to do is protect their income streams from the donor, you know, which means protecting the donor class. And usually what they have to do is make false promises to their base and then pull the rug after they get voted in and say, we couldn't do it because Joe Manchin or the Senate parliamentarian or whatever. But what they see as such a great advantage this time is Trump is screwing everything up so much. We don't even have to lie to our base. We can run on pure hollowness, on absolute nothingness. We could probably squeak out a win this way. We've not promised anybody anything, and we could just service our donors after that, purely. And like, well, we didn't even promise you anything, so shut up.
Yep.
And I think that's pretty much the strategy.
Yeah, there are sites like Yahoo where desperate people and well-meaning people who aren't that sophisticated, I would guess, are saying, vote blue. We can't have this. And you'll vote blue and you'll accomplish nothing and nothing will change. You'll at most get a slightly more polite, decorous, sort of nasty fascism.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly feel bad when you see really smart, well-meaning, civically engaged people on social media constantly having these like intelligent arguments with the wind, which is to say with the Democratic Party. Why are the Democrats doing this? Why, like, after all these years, you have to understand that's what the party is. Like that, if they had just changed their name to the, you know, slightly lesser evil party. And you voted for him for that because you think they're slightly less evil. And that, you know, there's an argument to be made at that, but you don't expect them to actually do anything good. They're just slightly right. less evil, maybe. Okay. And that's debatable, but that's a debate that's more at least rational to have, you know? And if you did that, then, you know, but if you actually expect that party, which is by design, like, I don't know, by any materialistic analysis, it is rotten
by its weakness.
Yes. Yeah. Its weakness and its corruption. I mean, it is profoundly, deeply corrupt. It cannot be changed without, I don't know, completely smashing it the way Trump smashed the GOP, let's say. But we're dealing with something different. We're dealing, you know, Trump is a dangerous capitalist who smashed the, you know, one faction of the capitalist class's party. But it's like you replace it with a different version of capitalism. But to, you know, to smash the Democratic Party through kind of democratic social, through some kind of socialism, which is what is popular and what's needed, you're really going against a capitalist party. You're going against the whole freaking, like, what it actually is. So it's very, very, very hard. And there's not structurally a lot, sadly, you can do. I mean, you're brought up to believe America has all this democracy, but the reality is, it is by design essentially impossible to A, create a third party that's viable. And that's by design legally. That begins, all the structural changes were imposed by the two parties in response to the populist party's success back in the 1880s and 1890s. They want to make sure that never happened again because the populace almost just, you know, almost destroyed like the system and brought in actual democracy. And then, you know, and then other changes since then. And the other place where there's absolutely no democracy is foreign policy, just none, zero. And it's, you know, I don't know how you change that. It probably would take a cataclysmic event of some kind, and that would probably go bad.
I guess, and Mark, I know you understand American history better than I do, but the last one, I suppose, was the Great Depression that threatened to move a big chunk of the electorate into more radical territory, but I guess they managed to fix it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as they say, FDR, they called him a traitor to his class because he was, you know, certainly probably the most socialistic president we had, maybe LBJ to a certain extent too. But also he saved the capitalist system by sort of socializing it a lot. And, you know, I just don't see we're anywhere near having something like that again. I mean, people are so depoliticized these days and so alienated from the political culture.
I think someone responded to our discussion of this issue a few episodes ago by saying, and it was a good point, I admit, don't you remember what happened to those high-class Ivy League students who started to make a fuss about Trump's alliance with Israel and its human repercussions? They were blacklisted in every possible way. And, you know, they still have a career to think about. And that's probably why you don't see masses of young people in the streets like you did over the Iraq War. I don't know if that's entirely true, but it seemed like a good point.
A lot of lives have been destroyed, and they're still getting destroyed over that. In fact, just over the last like week or two, three professors got fired at different universities for speaking out against Israel and Israel's role in this war. So if people are wondering why we're talking politics, and because we have to, because the U.S. has gone completely crazy, certainly the president has, he's doing madman praxis, and he doesn't quite understand the madman theory game. He's too authentically madman, And the Iranians are not the right people you play Madman Theory with. And like, one of the things about Madman Theory is, you know, you use Madman Theory, he might do it, he might bomb the shit out of him, in order to coerce the other side into, you know, a somewhat better negotiating position, that you have a better negotiating position with them. But if every time you've gone to negotiate with them, you've murdered them, and then you're bombing them into smithereens. Like, at some point, the madman praxis actually forces the other side to take a maximalist position, to not give it, like, for its own safety, it has a much better chance of fighting back to the end than it does trying to give in to your coercion. And that's what he's done. He's forced them.
Right, exactly. And, I mean, you had a great tweet explaining this. And I don't know if people understand the context of the Madman Theory, but it had a perhaps exaggerated reputation after Nixon's negotiations or alternating negotiations and outbursts with the North Vietnamese leadership. And I think Kissinger, blew up that position enormously and served as its official theory basis. I don't know if it ever really worked. But if there's an entity with which it is not going to work, it is the Shia clot of religious / political leaders who have come to the top in Iran, because the Shia are defined by their willingness to die. I mean, it is the test. I'm not sure this really percolates down to individual decision-making, but as you say, they're damned either way when dealing with someone as unstable as Trump. So it would certainly be a consolation to fall back on 1,200 years of Karbala or something like that, and the thought of holy martyrdom.
I mean, the way Ali Khamenei, the former supreme leader who was killed, the way he just sort of, there's no other way to really explain it. There was a sort of fatalism for not going into the bunker like he did in the 12-day war, just going to his office and knowing, well, that's how I might die, but it's better for the nation and for myself and my legacy if I do that than if I die waiting for the bunker busters to work their way down into my bunker, right? Like, while I'm hiding. I think also we should look at, I mean, when we talk about what the options are with the Trump regime, I mean, Trump and Hegseth have been firing army generals left and right, including the army chief of staff. And I don't know, one has to assume it's not just about DEI. I think there's dissension there. That's usually what that means in the heat of a war, and a war's not going well, and then suddenly you fire a dozen plus generals. Usually that's because things aren't going well and you're having dissension in the ranks. And I think
there were many generals willing to say, either before they left or as they left, that this was a stupid idea. And there's also the mute record of many administrations before this who were not stayed by any sense of mercy toward the Iranian people, but very good calculations that there really was no way that we could do this without doing more harm to the American economy than we would do to the Iranian state. And I think that was quietly the consensus among the foreign policy community. They didn't much want to say it out loud because it's like acknowledging defeat in advance. Mm-hmm. But they all thought that.
Yeah. Interesting side note here, according to the reports I've read, it was really two people who played the the most direct role, two confidants, let's say, of Trump, and the most direct role in persuading him to launch the war, both in 2025 and then this year, and that it would go great. And one, of course, was Netanyahu, as we know. But the other was Rupert Murdoch. I was kind of surprised. Wow. And, you know, so Rupert Murdoch, this 95-year-old, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre grandpa ghoul, convinced 80-year-old Trump to light the world on fire. I really think there's something, John, to what you've said about these old dying people wanting the world to die with them. I mean, it's a real argument. It's funny. The Soviet gerontocracy was notable because it was all about decay and inertia. You know, they made one disastrous kind of forward mistake, which was invading Afghanistan in stupidity and fear and then not knowing how to get out of it. But otherwise, it was inertia that defined them. And our gerontocracy is defined by its absolute violent, apocalyptic insanity. And same with Biden. Yeah,
it's like I think Babylonian or Assyrian monarch who's depicted in a famous painting killing his 100 or so wives or having his slaves kill them before the Assyrians or whatever other enemy was approaching could get to his palace. I mean, Trump is doing that. I mean, and there are many echoes of the ancient world in this moment, like the beautiful Homeric Greek story of the oracle, which when asked, I think by Croesus himself,
right,
what would happen if he attacked Iran? And I think this was Iran.
Persia, yeah, it was Persia.
And the oracle said, if you attack Persia, a great empire will fall.
Yes.
He kind of took it the
goody.
Wrong way.
Yes. Oh, goody. Yeah, yeah. It can only mean one thing. Yeah. I mean, getting back to who we are dealing with. So Trump and the Israelis, you know, decapitate, as they call it, assassinate. More pragmatic leaders, as we've said all along, like Ali Khamenei, like Larijani, the former security chief who was killed, who was really well-liked by a lot of people who don't really like the regime, as it's called, but like the people generally spoke highly of, not as like, you know, a great kind man, but as somebody who's very smart, very pragmatic, very hard-nosed, somebody you could do business with. Wasn't Larijani, I think, was the Kant scholar as well. A lot of these guys are these like philosophy PhDs. But just look at Larijani. So this is a very, very powerful person and a powerful post. This is, he was the head of the Supreme National Security Council, which is effectively running wartime Iran. So Mokhtar Khamenei, the new Ayatollah's supreme leader, whatever you call him, he's much more deeply aligned with the IRGC. And the person that replaced Larijani is somebody far more hardline, as you know, the Western conception of it would go. Mohammed Zolgahdar, if I'm pronouncing that right. So this is a former, you know, Revolutionary Guards commander. He was fighting as a guerrilla, even sort of in the 70s against the Shah, fought in, of course, in the Iran-Iraq War. His specialty is asymmetrical warfare, but he was always considered a real hardline radical. And in fact, in the late 90s, when he got promoted to being, I think it was deputy of either the Quds Force or the IRGC, a deputy to Soleimani, Qassem Soleimani, the one that Trump assassinated. Soleimani thought that Zolgahdar was too extreme and threatened to resign. And it took a lot of effort to paper it over to even keep Soleimani in place because he hated Zolgahdar and thought he was much too much of a hothead and an extremist. He was very close with Ahmadinejad. You remember the sort of the reactionary populist president. He served as his top internal security guy. So this is now the guy who's basically in charge of all, you know, of kind of wartime Iran.
Yeah, I mean, I think Trump has been getting intelligence from various spy agencies, and they tend to be very eager for momentary advantage in the world of assassination. Yeah. And I'm sure they told him all these guys are going to be gathering at Khamenei's office and we can get them all in one shot. And then just after that's finished, Trump says in the stupid, stupid way that really dumb people gloat, "Oh, yeah, we want to make a deal with somebody, but they've all been wiped out. We've killed them all. Har, har, har."
I would bet he's just getting a lot of also massaged intelligence because nobody wants to get screamed at by him. And, you know, the sycophants around him will tell him his whims are right, his gut is right. And Netanyahu's been promising if we do A, B, and C that the regime will fall. And then we'll hit this guy and the person who will replace him will be a lot more amenable. And your Venezuela, you know, coup worked so brilliantly. We can do that here. And they're not going to tell him, and he's not going to want to hear because he will scream and won't believe it anyway. They're not going to say, "Hey, it's actually gone really badly. The people that are now in power are impossible to actually do a deal with. Their demands are much stronger." You know, and the Israelis are not going to be like, "Oops, sorry, we were wrong." Like, they'll be like, no, we just have to do this other thing and everything will go right. But anyway, so, you know, getting back to Trump's tweet to finish it, he says, you know, "A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. I don't want that to happen, but it probably will. Now that we have complete and total regime change," which I just described, which is a much more hardline regime, "where different, smarter, and less radical minds prevail." That's how he describes these people. "Maybe something revolutionarily wonderful can happen. Who knows? We will find out tonight. One of the most important moments in the long..." This, of course, follows on the Easter message, which was, you know, "You send him to fucking hell and praise be to Allah."
The praise be to Allah particularly shocked me because I thought there was at least, well, I thought there were a lot of things that turned out not to be true, I guess. Time to admit that. But I thought there was at least a general norm of middle-class American courtesy that forbade openly mocking anyone's religion.
I know. It was pretty stunning. I guess what he's doing is he's appealing to his base because MAGA's kind of splitting. And this is kind of candy for the base. Some
for
of
the
them.
Part of it that's going with him anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I would think it would make, I mean, a lot of his base are middle class Christians. And I'm not saying they're not bloodthirsty, but I don't know.
MTG, I think, criticized that part of the message specifically.
So did Tucker. Tucker was like, "You don't, you know,
you don't insult Muslims.
You don't insult religion. Like, this is unchristian," is what he's. It's completely unchristian. And I mean, that's his argument. And on Easter, I mean, the whole thing is just, it's crazy. And I think it's Trump doing madman praxis, but with the wrong opponent and done in the wrong way. And he's really kind of boxed himself into a corner. I mean, he's put off this deadline, which is tonight. As we record this, it's tonight, like 8 p.m., I think, Eastern time.
Yeah, that's another cliche of cheesy cinema. Like,
yes.
"I'm really going to do it. I'm really going to do it. Okay, I'll give you another 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But right then, I'm going to do it."
This is what I have to do with my kids sometimes to get them to, like, shower or whatever. Like, "You have 2 minutes. Okay, you have one more minute." You know, it's... It's insane because I think Trump, again, he's boxed himself into a corner. His madman credibility, well, he knows it. I mean, he's an entertainer and he understands, I think, at some level how this stuff works. His madman credibility is massively reduced if he doesn't follow through tonight.
Yeah.
So he's boxed himself into a corner. He pretty much has to, unless there's a way that he can get a deal that he can plausibly sell as some kind of a victory. And I guess what that would mean, if this were to happen, now, as we've been recording this, John, it's been reported that the Iranian state has officially cut off all contacts with Trump because of his threats. And hundreds of thousands, I think millions of Iranians are already now walking out to different power plants and different sites and surrounding it with their bodies.
That's impressive. That's a noble gesture. I hope it doesn't get too many people killed.
I know. Including there was a tweet by Ghalibaf. He's the Speaker of Parliament, and he's kind of one of the he's a good tweeter. I'll say that. He's considered a hardliner, and he's kind of one of the main, at least, political voices in. I don't mind using the word regime, even though it's a pejorative, because the regime describes something that is actually actually multi-layered. Like with us, we just say Trump because he actually does have so much specific power just in him, whereas Iran is really...
It's a much more democratic arrangement.
Yeah, I know it is, and a much more checks and balances.
Yeah.
So Ghalibaf tweeted out, there was a list of, I think, 14,376,758 Iranians who had signed up to form human chains around these various power plants. And he just signed up plus one with a hashtag martyr for Iran. And somebody explained to people, because they didn't get it, somebody explained, this is, you know, Iran's parliament speaker, Ghalibaf, registered with the 14.3 million Iranians in the Janfada campaign, volunteers ready to sacrifice their lives to defend Iran and to go out there.
That's a really noble gesture. And it's hard for me to summon up the thought that, you know, there are 14 million people that generous in spirit in Trump's base.
I mean, this
is very discouraging because, like, you can't. I have always resisted abjuring my own country, but this is not one of its better moments.
No, it's an absolute disgrace. And I think one thing underlying a lot of the way this is talked about and framed is this sense. It's a unspoken major premise, as we would have said in rhetoric, that none of this will really blow back to us. You know, that it may blow back in the region, there may be troops on bases, things will happen to, but it won't really blow back to America. Like, our specific lives won't be hurt. And I don't know how much longer that's going to last.
Yeah, I think it may not blow back, but it's more of the curve of an artillery shell. It will come down in a sort of parabola. And it will event. I think this will affect us. And,
I do too. Absolutely.
I do feel better off. I sometimes regret not having kids, but feel better off. And I'm sorry, Mark.
I think about this a lot. You're right. It frightens me. It frightens me for them because I do think this is deeply fucking up the world, this country, and the world, especially the world that this country has relied on for a long time. And we're so early in on this. And, you know, unless we get lucky, super, super, super lucky, and there's some diplomatic way out of this, which I don't believe is possible, you know, this has so much longer to go, because the Iranians, basically, you have on one side, Trump is demanding the Iranians say uncle, as he said, I want them to cry uncle. They won't cry uncle. I don't know why. And he genuinely does not understand why. And it will take him and the circle that he's in, the bubble he's in, a long time, a lot of pain to understand why. And the Iranians will suffer a lot of pain, and the whole world will suffer that pain.
In fact, I want to remind people again of General Westmoreland, who ran the American effort in Vietnam, saying something very similar to what the Trump people will end up saying. We won that war because we killed X number of Vietnamese and they only killed Y number of us. And anytime you get that 12-to-1 kill ratio, you've won. Yeah, except that we didn't. Yeah. And he could never, never, never understand that. And he was also kind of a stupid person. And that's why, basically. And there are a lot of stupid people who've risen to the top of Trump's administration, and they're going to say this to their graves.
I mean, yeah, I think you've mentioned this before, but he has been saying essentially Westmorelandy things. He's been saying, we're destroying them. Like, he basically said, he said this directly. We've already won militarily. We've destroyed them. We defeated them. They're just not recognizing it. I mean, he's saying it in a way that is actually what they're all thinking, but they never put it quite that way, the Westmoreland brain types. And when he puts it that way, he obviously sounds so fucking stupid, because it's such a meat-headed understanding of what war is and what winning and losing wars are.
And to that end, I think we should leave a cliffhanger here, because tomorrow is the day that he's promised, I don't know what. What is he really threatening or promising?
The Israelis are saying they're going to destroy all the railroad networks. He's saying he's going to destroy all the power plants and send them back in the Stone Age. That's the first thing he's going to do. And he's also going to hit things that you wouldn't believe. Like, I'm expecting that Trump will hit something like, really important buildings like holy sites and or presidential palace or whatever they would have, the parliament, but like buildings that are very prominent, I would expect them to hit, because that's the kind of thing Trump wants. Yeah. The last thing I would say, John, is just to think about what Iran will, if they do that, and Iran has promised to, to create absolute havoc and chaos, which they can do, if Trump and Israel launch their full-scale attack like this, or if they go ground war, whatever the hell they're going to do. I was thinking, what could Iran do? And we'll find out tomorrow, of course. But just real quickly, I think this is my guess that Ansarallah, the Houthis, they closed the Bab al-Mandeb Straits, so that shuts off the Red Sea. So you have the Red Sea cut off, and the Strait of Hormuz, the Persian Gulf, cut off like that. And then Iran and the Houthis take out the Saudi Yanbu terminal and the whole port and the refinery system, because if you followed it, like, the Saudis have rerouted, they have a pipeline that goes from the east where the oil fields are in the Persian Gulf, directly west to the Red Sea. It can't carry as much, so it's about half as much oil can be exported, but at least that's still half as much. It's still 5 million barrels per day. But it's very fragile, very delicate, and all it needs are a few ballistic missiles and drones, and that's taken out, which sends oil through the roof.
And if I remember right, the radical who has replaced Larijani is himself a veteran of the Iranian irregular warfare operations,
yes.
Which terrified absolutely everyone in the West.
Yep.
Maybe 20 years ago.
No,
and
absolutely.
I'm waiting for that other shoe to drop.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, so it's very significant that he is now basically the head of the wartime government. It's insane what's going on right now.
Yeah.
That, and I would also expect, other things the Iranians could do, take out the rest of Qatar's LNG production. That would take, 20, I think they've destroyed 17% of their LNG facilities, extremely flammable, and takes 3 to 5 years to come back online. If they destroy the rest of the trains, that takes out 20% of global liquefied natural gas for the next 3 to 5 years. I mean, we're talking absolute, you know, global economic chaos, which is coming to one degree or another anyway. It's already hitting. And then, of course, they could take out desalination plants and make a lot of these Gulf countries uninhabitable, which would force a diversion of resources to try and keep them alive, you know, and afloat. Like, there's a lot of chaos that they can do. But as you said, we're at a cliffhanger moment recording this show. We shall see. It looks, it honestly, from what the way it looks here within America, it looks to me like Trump wants a way out. And he's screaming more and more madman stuff in order to get somebody to end the fight. Like, it's like a crazy person who really doesn't want to fight. So he's screaming, looking for somebody to hold back the other guy as well, because things could get so ugly. And the Iranians are just like, look, this doesn't end on your terms, because if it does, you're just going to attack us again in 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
This has to end with a brand new security architecture where we have guarantees that this isn't going to happen again. And it's very hard to construct something like that. Trump is nowhere near willing to concede, which would, that would basically be like conceding defeat. So I don't see a way out of this.
No.
Yeah.
And we're going to take it up tomorrow,
I guess. I guess so.
See what has happened or what will have happened.
Mm-hmm. In that tense. All right. Thank you so much, John, Brendan, and everyone. And talk to you all too soon, if there's a tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Right. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.